You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
John Tinsman, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Marty. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on such short notice, too. I think we threw this together less than 12 hours ago. I'm excited to have this conversation because we've had analysts covering the AI space on quite a few times over the last year. Jordy Visser, probably the most prominent. I've really liked his coverage and was telling you before we hit record, I found some clips of you talking about your thesis and what you're doing, and said I had to reach out to John, get him on the show. And for anybody who's unaware, John is the founder and portfolio manager of AOT Invest, which trades on NASDAQ. He's also the director of procurement and investments at Twin State Inc., a family fertilizer business, which is maybe a topic we can get to later. But I think really respecting your time and jumping into it, I think first laying out your framework, and I believe your thesis is low marginal cost, high growth businesses, trying to find who can outlay the least capital and get the highest multiple on that capital for your ETFs. And I think just walking us through that, because most people hear AI investing, they think NVIDIA, but your framework filters for something more specific from what I understand.
Yeah. So my first ETF I launched in 2022 is AOTG. That's the ticker, the AOT Growth and Innovation ETF. You know, I came from the world of market making, which was all about high speed and algorithmic trading and statistical probability. So I tried to take that statistical probability to long-term investing. And so when you invest, you know, 10 years from now, you can almost guarantee that the stocks that have gone up the most have had the best earnings growth. So like in 10 years, if there's a company that's earning 30x more, that is probably have gone up quite a bit. So I think like when you invest for the future, you think, well, what companies give me the best probability of earning the most in the future? And so the first thing I came back to was the companies that are earning the most today, like growing the fastest earnings today. So like companies that have really high earnings growth statistically are the most likely to be doing that again tomorrow. So I target and I weight by high earnings growth and high revenue growth, which is really unlike modern investments, I think, because the modern investments, I think, fall into two categories. You've got the index funds that are weighting by market cap. So like if you have a growth fund, Apple might be a top weight, and Apple's like barely growing faster than inflation, right? And so why would you not put a top weight in something like Micron instead if they're growing their revenue at 300% year over year? You know, like it's a good question to ask. Why would you not weight higher on companies like AMD and SanDisk if they're growing their earnings at 1,000% year over year? You would think in a growth fund, you would want the highest possible growth. So that's what I do in AOTG. Then the other thing about active management, modern active management, is that they focus a lot on like the betas and the Sharpe ratios and things like that. And that was kind of counterintuitive because you're using a backward looking volatility metric. So like it's not necessarily indicative of the future. Meanwhile, you kind of avoid companies that are doing really well if they just go up and down too much, maybe like SanDisk and Micron. So like I kind of take a common sense approach to buying high growth companies at the most reasonable valuation metrics possible. So if there's something like super overpriced like Palantir, it won't be in my fund. Even if it has decent growth, like why would you even bother wasting your ammunition on it if you can buy something at 1/10 the valuation metrics, 3x the growth? So I take that approach with AOTG. And then number two, the second highest thing I found correlated with long-term stock price performance in my research was low marginal cost. And I think this one's really interesting because nobody else was focusing on it. And that's the second criteria for AOTG, high growth and low marginal cost. So low marginal cost is the cost to produce one additional unit of good. So think about a company like Microsoft. If they make one additional unit of Microsoft Office and sell it to you, that costs them nothing to make. That means they have 100% profit margin, which is great for shareholders. That means they can scale to meet demand without any debt. And then they can also have an enormous amount of free cash flow to keep innovating. So you've got higher innovation, higher profits, higher growth. You compare that to a traditional company like Boeing. If they have to build another airplane for, you know, and they're selling it for $100 million, it might actually cost them $99 million. And if they really want to grow, so they have a very low profit margin on new sales. And if they really want to grow, they have to build new factories. And then they have to sell product at a negative profit margin to steal the business from a company like Airbus. So growth, not only is it funded by huge amounts of debt, it comes instead with 100% profit margins. It comes with negative profit margins and losses. So that's traditional industry. I learned this in my family business, a fertilizer, because I always like, I'm an ambitious guy. It's like, let's grow the business. And everybody's like, no, if you grow the business, you'll just light your money on fire and you'll never see it again. And so it's like, let's just be happy with what we have. And it was hard for me to wrap my head around that being, you know, wanting to grow and do better than the year before every year. So I take that investment approach that I've learned from personal, you know, managing family businesses and took it to an ETF and focus on that high growth, low marginal cost within profitable businesses. And so it's been out for, you know, 3.5 or 4 years and it's up, you know, it launched at 24 on the NASDAQ and it's trading, I think it traded yesterday in the 63. So in that short amount of time, it's up over 160%. So it's been great to do well for shareholders. Of which I'm a big one, of course. It's like, oh, would I have all my money in?
Well, I mean, jumping like deeper into the framework and particularly, I think your hottest thesis right now, which is being all over this XAI Anthropic deal, which was announced, I believe, last week or the week before, where Anthropic, I believe they're paying, what, 1.9, 1.6 to 1.9 billion a month in compute from one of the Colossus sites.
Yeah. And I tweeted about it because I hadn't seen anybody talk about it. I'd seen people talk about, oh, they're leasing it, but nobody had talked about the profitability metrics. They opened up, and it's so crazy, Marty, they opened up the S1 and they're like, oh, ha, 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 look at how much money XAI is losing. And in that, they basically had $15 billion a year coming online like next month. So like in like 3 days. And they somehow didn't realize that it's going to be making money. Like not only is the XAI revenue going to jump 300%, maybe a lot more, but year over year, but also they're going to be making a ton of money. And so everybody was just kind of wrong on their take. And so I tweeted this and like all the celebrities are in the replies. It's gotten like hundreds of thousands of views on X, maybe millions by now. I haven't checked. But the interesting thing is that they spent $3 to $4 billion. Some people say as high as $7 billion. And these are kind of closely guarded secrets. You kind of have to look at how much XAI was spending and try to say, okay, how much of that did they spend on Colossus One? But they built a 300 megawatt data center. They did it in 122 days. And, you know, this thing probably costs a couple $100 million a year to run on the very highest side. You know, it might cost only 150. I don't know. So if they spent $4 billion on it, let's just say, and they lease it to XAI for $15 billion a year for 3 years, they will make $45 million on a $4 million invest or billion, $45 billion on a $4 billion investment. So that's a 10x ROI. And I think in 3 years, the asset is probably will have appreciated in value. So like, I don't think like it's depreciating. I think it'll still be very useful in 3 years. So the ROI is really a lot higher than 10x. And in my opinion. And so that's like the tip of the iceberg, because I think this is a closely guarded secret in the industry. Nobody wants to talk about how much money they're making in data centers because they don't want everybody to know. At the same time, the hyperscalers are spending $1 trillion now this year building them. And, you know, did you know like Microsoft and Google historically, their return on capital invested is over 35%. And why are they spending so much more now? Is the ROI trending upwards to 100%? And if you look at Google Cloud, if you look at Microsoft Azure, if you look at Amazon Web Services, Oracle, it seems like it quite possibly is. Like the revenue growth is accelerating, the profit margins are getting fatter and fatter. And I think there's a chance that what we're doing is we're building data centers in the US and we're leasing it out to the rest of the world at like 90% profit margins. And I live in Iowa. I'm not sure where you are, Marty. But like the data center boom here is huge. Like my neighbors work for Oracle, electricians and welders that used to be making like $50,000 a year, making $250K a year building these things. And like they're going up everywhere. And it's just bringing in an enormous amount of wealth. But here's the crazy thing. You talk to these people and they're booked out 5 years. Like, mm-hmm. Like the data center demand's not going down. Meanwhile, Anthropic grew their tokens sold by 80x in 12 months. And Goldman Sachs is saying they think they're going to see another 24x token demand growth. And so, like, we are so far past like 20% revenue growth, 34% revenue growth. When you're starting 80x, 24x, how do you even value that? And it's so bullish. The ROI is so good on data centers that is people really going to order less semiconductors? Because people are like, are we at the top of a cycle? And you look at the numbers and you're like, this is absurd. I've never seen anything like this before. And so I think there's like, while it's always good when you invest to have a little bit of pessimism and make sure you keep in mind the downside potential, I think it's really good to be focused on the upside right now and not to kid yourself about like what the potential is.
Can't be dooming. Can't be dooming, especially not right now. And it's funny, today in our newsletter, we actually covered it. We've been sleuthing the banking reports. The one came out of Morgan Stanley yesterday where they're citing these CapEx numbers and they're warning. They're saying, has AI made the U.S. economy inelastic? Hyperscaler CapEx estimates nearly doubled to $805 billion for 2026. Headed towards $1.1 trillion in 2027. Mm-hmm. U.S. GDP has been revised up to plus 2.3%. S&P earnings growth revised up plus 23%. Their thesis is that Google, Microsoft, Meta, and Amazon aren't cutting CapEx in response to higher rates because AI spending is too strategic, too essential, or too well-funded to care. If the biggest spenders in the economy are rate insensitive, the Fed's transmission mechanism is weaker than at any point in history. So they're making a comment on this CapEx spending as juxtaposed to high rates and what the Fed may want to do moving forward. And I think to your point, what people haven't really grokked is the ROI on these CapEx investments, particularly if you own the compute and the energy infrastructure is so high, it's hard to pass up.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things to think there. One, like if the Fed raises rates 1 or 2% and your ROI is 100%, or actually like in XAI's case, like 1,000%, do you even care? And the answer is, of course not. The second thing is, you have to remember, all these hyperscalers were sitting on like more cash together than the U.S. Treasury had. So they were sitting on huge amounts of cash. And somehow we're supposed to be sad that they're spending it, right? And they're spending it with like the most absurd ROI we've ever heard of. So like somehow some people want you to be bearish about that. Like, oh my gosh, look at, they're spending their cash that they had hundreds of billions sitting on cash on hand. And we should be sad that they're building stuff with it. And then like, you know what they're doing, right? Like you build compute, but then you're leasing it out to customers in like Europe and you're leasing it out to customers from Africa or the Middle East. So like our compute is really funding and training the whole rest of the world. So we're not talking about like serving 300 million. Our compute is serving the whole 7 billion people of the world. And so the scale of this is not like domestic. The scale of this is international. And the ROIs are great. And they're not, in a lot of cases, they're not borrowing money to do it. So they are, some of them are, like obviously Oracle is, you know, people like that. But like a lot of them are using it with their own cash on hand or funding it with their current revenues, right? Because like if Microsoft has, you know, a 50% profit margin, that means that they can roll 50% of the profits into building data centers, right? So like it's that, I do agree that that spending's not going to slow down and the Fed doesn't really have any control over that. And by the way, that's a good thing because what we're doing is we're bringing in profits from the whole world to the US. We're winning the AI race. And our shareholders, you know, our people in like my neighborhood in Iowa, like everybody's flourishing from it, right? The stock market's at rock guard highs and it's something to celebrate. And you see like people on like Elizabeth Warren, like I saw she tweeted like, we need to tax these people and stuff. Like they're mad that they're doing well. And I'm like, how can you be mad about that? Like we all want to win as America and that's what we're doing. That's what it looks like we're doing. And I'm super excited. I think it's one of the most exciting times to be investing.
Yeah. And to this point, too, what are the barriers to entry to this compute leasing market? Is it the constraints of the energy grid and access to power and power infrastructure? Like how long can these ROIs persist? Is it because of the supply of the infrastructure is still constrained?
Well, we have a lot of natural gas in the U.S. And so like in Iowa, what they do, we have natural gas pipelines that run up from like the shale drillers. And what in Iowa, what they do is they build their own generators onto the data centers. And then they try to get like wind energy too and things like that. But like generally they're bringing their own power. So Is it a concern if we use more natural gas when we have plenty of it and we're exporting it to the rest of the world? Like, I don't think so, because it's pretty stupid to put natural gas on a natural gas tanker and send it to Europe to power a data center over there and raise the cost of natural gas like $20. You know what I mean? Like, how dumb is that? Like, it's so expensive to ship it. Why don't we just do the compute here, save the $20, you know, a cubic, whatever, of natural gas? Like, it's everything's more efficient about it. And do the compute closest to where the energy is, you know? So I think there's two things. You need land and you need, but the craziest thing is you've got places like California that are just full of empty deserts. Like, they won't let them build data centers there. I don't know. So we're building them in Iowa, I guess. So Iowa farmland is a little more productive than California desert, unfortunately, but that's the way things are. So, but yeah, I mean, it's just, it's good for everybody involved, and it's going to be really good, I think, for shareholders when we start to see the ROI roll in from the data. I mean, we've hardly seen any of these data centers come online. Elon Musk was like one of the first ones to do it because he could build them so fast. But like, we're going to see in the next year these come online and the revenues come in. And that's going to be really exciting for shareholders.
Yeah, that Memphis build out. I was telling you before we hit record, I was been in the Bitcoin mining industry for almost 10 years now, and watching how they did Colossus One by daisy chaining to gen sets and putting the battery powers, the battery walls inside. He was acting like a Bitcoin miner, because a Bitcoin mining, to your point, the whole name of the game is basically shortening the distance between the power production and the compute. And it seems like AI is adopting that quickly as well. And I mean, to that point, it looks like SpaceX is going to build another large data center, Colossus 2. It looks like it may be a $17 billion outlay.
Yeah, for 2 gigawatts. So like, if you can lease out 300 megawatts for $45 billion, how much can you lease out 8 times more compute for? Like, if they only spend $17 billion, it sounds like at the current rate, they could lease that out for over $100 billion. They could lease that out for over, I was way low on that, but they could lease that out for over $300 billion. Mm-hmm. So, like, I mean, if you do a 10x ROI on it, like, they're getting on whatever. I mean, it's a lot. And how's that going to be for SpaceX shareholders? So SpaceX is going to go public in like 2 weeks. You know, they obviously can grow their Starlink division. I mean, it provides so much value. I think Starlink could easily 10x their revenues over the next 5 years. And then what can they bring in from compute? And, you know, this is really smart. They have to build the compute leasing business before they take it to space. Because, like, you don't want to go to space with no customers. So, like, you build the customer base, and then you take it to space. And it's so strategic. It's so smart. And the biggest question I have, like, I think I'm going to be pretty bullish on SpaceX when it IPOs in 2 weeks. But the other question is, what are the best plays to make money off of these rising compute, like, leasing profits? And is it like the hyperscalers like Oracle and Google and Microsoft? Or is it some of the smaller ones like CoreWeave, Iren, and some of the Bitcoin miners that are rotating to the leasing out their compute, like TeraWulf, you know, the ticker's WULF, and Cypher. So I think that's pretty exciting. And it's hard to know for sure who are the winners. Can the bigger people like Elon Musk just do it faster and better? Or can people that are in like Texas and they have really friendly regulations down there and they own a lot of the land, can they scale a lot, like, the fastest? So I think a lot of this is going to be who can scale the fastest and get it done quickly and have that edge to bring in the revenue first. And I don't know what the future holds, but I do think it's going to be good for shareholders.
What's up, freaks? This work was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. Guys, things happen. Things get lost. You need to replace your phone. Life happens. And BitKey has been designed with this in mind. So if you're looking for the easiest way to secure your Bitcoin off the exchange, go get a BitKey. It doesn't come with any seed phrases. There's no single point of failure. It's a 2-3 multi-sig. You have your device. You have the mobile app, and Block stores a key in the server. So you have collaborative multi-sig there. On top of that, the new BitKey has a screen, so you can actually see and verify what you're approving. You can look at transactions, addresses, account changes. The difference between trusting and knowing has been built into the new BitKey with the screen. They have chain code delegation and other advanced features like inheritance, recovery. If you're looking to get your Bitcoin off exchange, you haven't done so, you're looking for the easiest way to do that, go get a BitKey. You can use our code today, TFTC, to get 10% off the new BitKey. So go download the BitKey app, use the code TFTC to get 10% off the new BitKey, and start your self-custody journey today. This episode has been sponsored by our good friends at BitKey.
Sup, freaks. When you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about one out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their model is simple. You hold two keys, they hold one key. And it always takes two keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com.
Well, I mean, that begs another question too. Like, how many winners could there be? I could see there being a lot of winners in this, just because of the insatiable demand for tokens. And it doesn't seem like, to your point of, I forget which bank was saying it, but the growth in token usage just in the last year. And if you think about robotics and things that haven't even come to market at scale yet that are going to demand probably exponential amounts of compute compared to the nascent agentic economy that exists now, you could see a ton of winners. And not only, and I think that begs another question. I sit on the board of Cathedra. We're in the process of merging with a company called Sphere 3D, but we operate on a lower scale, like 20 to 25 to 50 megawatt.
Well, I hope you have stock-based centers. Compensation.
Excuse me?
I said, I hope you have stock-based compensation.
Well, that's, I mean,
some stock options in case it spikes.
going back to, I mean, how many winners could there be? Could you see a scenario where there's a ton of winners?
Oh, of course. I think that's where we already are.
Yeah.
The question. So we've already seen a ton of winners in the semiconductors because first they have to order the stuff, right? So we've seen all this, like we've seen SanDisk and Micron. I mean, Micron was up like 20% the other day, like so many back-to-back 5, 10% days. It's crazy. And I think the thing is when you have like a 200% ROI and you really want this stuff because you want to get this data center built right now, how much pricing power does it give the semiconductors? And I think they're figuring that out. AMD, you know, NVIDIA, they can continue to raise their prices because these semiconductors that are crucial to the compute are generating such a high profit for the people that have the data center. So I see that profit, you know, continues, and they're just the first ones to see it. So the question is, like, when we built out like the first ones, we saw NVIDIA like skyrocket. It went up. It's earning like 25x more than a couple years ago. Its stock went up like thousands of percent because, of course, it's earning a lot more. And then we saw the memory chips go up, and those went up, you know, thousands of percent, like SanDisk and Micron. And now we've seen the CPU rally. So we've seen AMD and Intel really take off. And so the question is, you know, these are all people that are getting the orders to turn in to build the data centers and the products that they need to do them. But the question is, when the data centers come online, I think we're going to see the data center winners. And here's the thing, like almost all the semiconductors are doing well. So I could see a scenario where anybody that's been investing in the space gets a really high ROI on their data center, so long as they're like, you know, they're able to you know, do things like house quads, like Elon Musk's Colossus One is. So I think it's going to be great. It's just hard to know right now because you haven't really seen it in the earnings. So how much do you want to speculate to say, I think this is going to happen, versus how much do you want to be grounded in the earnings and wait for the results to come in first? But by that time, you know, if it turns out to be true, the stock will have probably already rallied quite a bit. And by the way, you've seen it in Cypher and Terra Wolf. They are up a lot. So there's people in on this trade already that are pushing these stocks. I mean, I'm pretty sure they're up like 500% in the last year. So there's other people that are, you know, that are moving before us, I think, on this one.
Yeah. And to that point, when do you think we'll know for sure that this is happening? Like you don't want to wait for those earning reports. Is this Q3, Q4 this year, Q1 next year? When do you think all these numbers will hit?
Well, I think like a month ago, people in the industry started to talk about it. And one of the people that posted it was like David Sachs. And he's like, hey, guys, like you can build a $50 billion data center and lease it out for $30 billion a year. And then like we just learned with what Elon Musk did that his numbers were way low, like way low. You can build a $50 billion data center and maybe lease it out for, you know, $150 billion a year. So like he was off by a magnitude of five. And that's what's happened, what we've seen in like memory chip stocks. And the analysts are just like, oh, they'll earn a little bit more next quarter. And then they go and they grow their revenue 100% quarter over quarter and just blow away everybody. And so I think it's hard. I think the thing is the market's used to valuing growth that's like 20%, 30% revenue growth, like year over year. Nobody knows how to value things that could grow by 25x earnings. Like, and nobody is that bullish. Nobody's like, Cypher is going to be earning 25x more next year. Oracle is going to be earning 30x more next year. So nobody really knows how to do that. And so I think the market frequently, especially in tech, especially when people can make at low marginal cost. So especially when you can make additional sales at 100% profit margins, nobody really knows how to value that. And when you think about the history of companies that have done that, like Google and Microsoft and Amazon and Visa, they've all crushed the S&P 500, like by enormous amounts. And so now we kind of have this next stage of these companies that can sell this compute at very high profit margins is what it seems. And yeah, do you want to be a first mover or do you want to wait 6 months to see it roll into the earnings and to be a little less speculative? So I think it's probably, you know, for me, it probably makes some sense to do a little bit of both, you know, go in, but be a little cautious and be ready to double down, you know, when the earnings come in.
What would slow this down? I mean, we've seen headlines in the last week, Uber has run through their compute budget for the year. They ran through it, I believe, mid-April. You have many other companies saying, hey, the use of these models isn't helping us add bottom line revenue to the business. Like, what could slow this down? Is it the inability for companies to actually integrate these models in a way that makes them more productive, more efficient, most importantly, more profitable? What could pop a hole in this growth story right now?
So I think the interesting thing is anybody buying these tokens in the first place has probably already really done the math on it, because you'd be pretty stupid to just buy tons of them and make it more expensive than human labor. Okay. So like, imagine this, you're sitting in a data call center and your job is literally just to answer the phone and take customer service calls. You know, so they're paying everybody $25 an hour. You have thousands of employees sitting in this call center. Like, you could have a chatbot that's like, oh, okay, like we've seen that you got a fee on this credit card, or this payment was fraudulent. Like, we're going to go ahead and reverse it and send you a new card. Like, you don't actually need a human to do most of this, like probably like 90% of the stuff. So almost every customer service call you take today, that's basically done by a token. That's like a tokenized chat box. So like with your credit cards, with your banks, pretty much all of that, they're buying tokens to fund what they're doing, to fund these agentic AI agents that are carrying out tasks that humans used to do. So like, first of all, I don't think that they're doing that because the ROI is bad. And then the second thing is in software development and like Uber and Salesforce, they're buying huge amounts of tokens too, because they can write 10 times the amount of code for 1/10 the cost. And so they're doing it because the ROI is really good on it. And they're the first mover. So you have to remember, when like somebody in New York City or Silicon Valley is doing this, the rest of the country and the rest of the world isn't even close to being where they are and adopting it. So like, you see like the first 1% moving. You don't see the other 99% yet. And that's why the token demand is like projected to just explode. Like, when I'm sitting here in Iowa, I don't know anybody that uses them. You know, but I talked to my friends that I went to like Northwestern and University of Oxford with, and they're work for some of the tech companies and stuff. And they're all like, yeah, we use this all the time, every day. And so I think we've seen the early adopters move, but we haven't seen the rest of the 99% of the world. And the rest of the world and the rest of the people in Iowa and everything, they're going to be buying those tokens from these companies, and the tokens are going to be made in the United States. They're not going to be made in Europe, where natural gas is 50 times higher. They're not going to be made in Africa. They're not going to be made in China. So like, we really are the answer to the whole world here. And you cannot, like, do you remember like Google, like $100 billion market cap? And people are like, oh, it's so big, it can't grow anymore. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they just forget that Google can go and sell their AdWords to the entire rest of the world, 100% profit margins. Like nobody can even fathom that the demand will actually be 50 times higher at 100% profit margins. Same thing with Microsoft. Like, and so they just underestimate it. And then the stock goes up, what? 10,000%? Like, so I think we're probably in the same scenario here. I just think it's like, I think it's just, the biggest threat would probably be that Anthropic tries to build their own data centers. But I still think that they're so far behind the ball and there's the demand is so big that they can't possibly do that. So, and they don't even have the capital to do it. So I'm not sure what could deflate this, but right now I'm not thinking not much. I'm thinking that there's not much that could deflate this at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, there's political opposition against it, but isn't that like even better? You know, like if the rest of the world doesn't want to build them because there's political opposition and the red states will, you know, like, isn't that better that we have like the place where we can break the red tape and put them up faster than anybody else anywhere in the world? So like that just gives us a bigger moat and it makes investing in them safer.
What's up, freaks? This rip is brought to you by good friends at CrowdHealth. I've been a happy CrowdHealth member for almost 5 years now. My wife and I have had two children while we've been on CrowdHealth, and I actually just got the last bill for our third child funded. It was $6,157. CrowdHealth negotiated down to $2,309, and we only paid $500. The rest was crowdfunded by the CrowdHealth Network. If you're sick of health insurance premiums and having to pay deductibles and getting ripped off at the hospital, join CrowdHealth. It's an alternative way to pay for your healthcare. It's not health insurance. It's crowdfunded healthcare. As you can tell, they negotiate prices for you. You pay in cash. It's much cheaper. Overall, we're much happier. They have incredible perks. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC to sign up. 5 years on CrowdHealth, not looking back. Joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC. Use the promo code TFTC. Once you set up your account, you're going to get $99 a month for your subscription for the first 3 months. All right, freaks. You know me. You know I don't take sponsor money from products I wouldn't use myself. So listen up. The Aven Bitcoin Visa card is one of the most interesting things I've seen in the Bitcoin lending space in a long time. Here's the deal. You can get a line of credit up to $1 million backed by your Bitcoin without selling a single sat. No gains, no annual fees, no minimum draws, and your Bitcoin is custodied by BitGo, which is one of the most trusted names in digital asset security. Aven never lends it out. There's no rehypothecation. You stay in control. And guess what? You can lock in a fixed rate for up to 10 years. That's 10 times longer than most lenders out there, or go interest only for up to 5 years. Rates start at 7.99% APR for a product that lets you keep your stack and still access liquidity. It's hard to beat. I mean, the duration in the rates is the best I've seen in the market to date. You also get 2% unlimited cash back every time you use the card. Spend fiat, keep your Bitcoin, the whole game. If you've been stacking for years and you need liquidity without triggering a taxable event, this is worth a serious look. Go to aven.com/Bitcoin. That's AVEN.com/Bitcoin. Check it out.
Yeah. I mean, and 2 points to add there. I think when it comes to implementation of these AI workflows or agentic workflows, it really comes down to being able to implement it. I think Jack Dorsey and Block are a great example. I've watched their implementation of AI into their company over the last year, and I think they're doing it the right way. And I think Jack's interview with the Sequoia partners a couple of months ago really highlighted how they're viewing it. And I think the approach to how you actually implement these AI systems is very important. There's going to be a ton of companies who don't think strategically about that, those implementation details that mess it up, and they wind up wasting a bunch of money. And then on the other hand, like, I think for small teams, like my humble media company that we're running here, we've been running an OpenClaw agent since January.
And
expanded our ability to do what we do here by orders of magnitude. And I think for small teams, it's going to be particularly powerful. And then when you think about the profit margins that can be gained by small teams that implement this from zero, the profitability of the smaller team is going to way exceed the larger companies that have a ton of bloat. And I think that's going to be actually an interesting theme to watch moving forward, is the incumbent behemoths that were using headcount as a KPI back in the easy money days of the 2010s and early 2020s, trying to unwind the mistake of that KPI.
Yeah. I mean, how amazing is it that like Elon Musk went in and like cut 80% to X and it worked just the same? You know what I mean? And I do think there's a thing of like, when people throw crazy money out at things, there's like kind of infamous for getting ripped off. And so what companies are run so well that they can build them the leanest? And I think they'll have a huge competitive advantage, right? To build them the fastest and the leanest. So you probably, honestly, it sounds like maybe you know more about some of these like data center place. And it's amazing that you're in this space on the board of a company. So you're going to know better than anybody, but it sounds like you don't want to scale back your Claude bot and it also sounds, or your OpenClaw. It sounds like you also like, so you would maybe use more, but it also, I would say you're a first mover because you're like a high tech guy. So like how soon until everybody else figures out what you're doing and how great it is?
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing. It's not right now. It's the other thing you have to consider too, is these models are progressing so quickly. So you'll build something 1 week and then a new model will be released. It's like, okay, I have to take this out, put this in and rejigger things a certain way. And it's a lot of learning on the go. And so to your point about like the early movers and not trying to blow smoke up my own ass, but it is like an involved process. And if you're not staying up to date with the latest developments in the space, it's going to be hard to keep up. But there will be a point, I think, where the model, the return on the model, sort of the model progression sort of plateaus, maybe it doesn't plateau, but it becomes more stable of a rise in efficiency gains. And I guess the IQ of the models themselves, that you'll be able to create out of the box solutions. Like setting up an OpenClaw in January was extremely hard. It's easier today. I imagine a year from now, there will be point and click out of the box sort of agentic flows for companies that are very easy to set up.
Yeah. I mean, and if demand grows by 24x or 80x, we don't have anywhere near amount of compute even what we're building today. It's nowhere close. So it honestly seems like it could be like an 8 or 10 year build out to catch up, which means we'd be in the very early, I mean, like in the first, like, you know, year or two, but very of like a decade long build out. So it could be one of the longest like CapEx cycles that's ever been in the history of the world. I mean, it can really only be compared to when they like needed to build railroads across like the whole world, because like, they realized that was better than taking stuff on a donkey.
Yeah. Well, and I think many people are comparing it to the internet and the broadband build out too. And to your earlier comments about people worrying about this being a bubble and it being too hard to believe, and they're pointing at the dot-com bubble. I think that's one thing that many people are missing, is that the demand for tokens is there. It's like the dot-com bubble, the infrastructure was built out and we didn't have the means to really lean into the digital economy that exists today in the 90s. And you weren't able to monetize websites the way you are today. There was a ton of sort of software development kit infrastructure and payments infrastructure and logistics infrastructure that needed to be built out. And Amazon and Google and many others did that in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then that caught up. But I think with AI, it's different because the models, they work. If you know how to use them, they work well for you and you want to use them more, but the tokens simply aren't there yet. The ability to ping the models as much as you want isn't there. Whereas in the broadband era, the fiber was there, it was laid, but the supply of people bringing businesses that actually worked on the internet wasn't there.
Yeah. I mean, and I think the thing is, it's like, it's kind of like the railroad, like Wells Fargo started as a carriage delivery, like a wagon delivery service. And so like they'd go down the Oregon Trail from whatever New York all the way down to Oregon. And it's like the railroad basically put that out of business overnight and they became a bank. But it's like, if you can do something for 1/1000th the cost, you know, and software has always been limited by extremely expensive developers sitting in seats. If you can lower things by 1/1000th of a cost, do you really ever go back to the way things were? Is there really any slowing down the adoption? Because its savings are so big, it only accelerates. And I think that's probably where we sit today.
Yeah. What, outside of compute infrastructure specifically, again, bringing back to energy, because that's one thing I've identified is maybe the biggest constraint right now is energy infrastructure. I know you talked about natural gas pipelines, but I think we really need to expand generation and grid interconnectivity by orders of magnitude in the next decade as well. And I think that's another part of the market that provides an incredible opportunity. And it's
the data centers aren't. So I think if the data centers are bringing their own energy and they barely connect to the grid, then one, is that true? And two, like, there's people like Bloom Energy making like obviously they make electric generators, right? So that you can like bring your own power to a data center. But like the question to that is that like, that's really expensive to build each data center. So, or to build each generator, I mean. So the question is, like, that's not low marginal cost, right? Like, you can make an additional memory chip for not a lot of cost, but it's really expensive to build a big generator. So the question is the earnings growth going to be the highest there? And like, producing electricity is always going to have a high marginal cost because it costs a lot to make, you know, whether it's a natural gas or wind turbines or solar, it actually costs something. And each additional unit you make is not free. It really has a cost associated with it. So I don't think the ROI is going to be the highest in that sector for that reason. Doesn't mean it won't be good. I think that you can make more money in semiconductors or something, in my opinion. I think the other thing that I think has really been overlooked is software in this. And I know the software, these are some of the people buying the tokens. And so there's some increased costs there because they maybe necessarily haven't scaled back their workforce. So they've like kept all the high costs, but they've also spent all the money on the tokens. So they were like kind of double slamming themselves. But software has always been limited by the number of subscribers sitting in a seat, right? So manpower is expensive. So here's the thing. Like, you open your OpenClaw and it's doing, you know, advertising work for you, and it's working in Adobe, and maybe you have one doing sales outreach for you, and it's working in Salesforce. Software is no longer limited by the number of people you have. So now you could have one person and they could have 20 subscriptions, right? Like, you could have the same thing drawing CAD drawings in Autodesk, right? Like, and so now the question is, does demand get totally unleashed? It was always limited by expensive manpower, and now software demand is totally unleashed because AI agents need the tools to get the work done. And so I think that could be like really interesting in that the demand is actually going to be higher. Additional sales come at 100% profit margins, and you have, you know, 5x demand or something as the tools just become, you know, because the most expensive thing to Adobe was never that a subscription cost of $300 a year, $1,000. It was the person that you were paying to do the work in it. You know what I mean? They might cost $100,000. So if you're lowering the cost to use these by a magnitude of 100, doesn't demand go up? And because the additional sales come at high profit margins, doesn't earnings like explode? And so I'm bullish on software. Like, I hold it in AOTG. You know, I have top, like, some of the like top holdings, or, you know, besides semiconductors and besides some of this AI infrastructure, are names like AppLovin and Microsoft and Toast. And so I think it could really be unleashed. And I think that the potential there, like, should not be understated, you know. And there's downside, of course, that some of them are losers, and always keep that in mind when you invest. But when everybody focuses on the downside and nobody focuses on the upside, And the PE ratios are like 15 and 20, and they're really reasonably valued with very robust earnings growth still today. I think that sets up to some of the best trades. And like, you saw that a year ago with memory, you know, everybody was bearish on it and the PE ratios were really low and the growth was good. And I think like when you have those things and you when you combine those all together, those are the makings of the best trades. And so we'll see what the future holds. You know, anything can happen, but I am excited for it.
Yeah, I think we saw an example of this a couple of weeks ago when Figma announced their Q1 earnings and they surprised massively to the upside. I think many people were thinking Figma UI designer tool was going to get blown out by people just building it themselves, but they actually implemented some AI functionality. And I think, to your point, what they experienced is people actually using them more because they had these tools to go in there and leverage their software tools.
Yeah. Well, here's the most interesting thing is a lot of these companies have like a 5-10% profit margin. So imagine you're a company like Spotify and you can look at the earnings today and their year over year operating expenses are falling. Meanwhile, they're still growing their revenues at 10%. So what that tells me is that their profit margin will go from 5% to all the additional, 10% sales go straight to profit. So now their profit margin will be 15%. Well, that's 200% year over year GAAP earnings per share growth for a company that had a low PE ratio. So, usually when they have low PE ratios, they shouldn't get any lower. Usually they should keep up with earnings growth. And so making 200% in a year is a big deal, in any stock, right? You know that. And so how many companies today, like AppLovin and Robinhood, are implementing? I mean, Robinhood's financial services, but what are they really? They're really proprietary software to implement brokerage services. So, how many of these companies are going to keep their expenses constant and grow their revenues, not just 10%, but maybe 50%. And AppLovin's obviously growing at 60%. And that's really, that really the upside of that potential, I don't think can be overstated.
Yeah. So you're not a doomer at this. You don't think AI leads to massive job disruption that completely throws the economy into a tizzy and destroys the demand for tokens that existed in the first place? Do you think this is going to be an accelerant for human productivity and creativity?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it brings in a lot of wealth. I just look at what it's doing in Iowa, and it seems like people are doing better than ever. And I think in the 1900, they were building the Panama Canal, and they came out with a steam shovel. And there was actually a political debate at the time with the presidents and stuff. Should we bring this steam shovel to Panama Canal because a bunch of people will lose their jobs? Or should we just keep paying all these people to die of malaria in Panama and keep doing it because we want them to be employed? And is that not crazy that they were considering digging the Panama Canal with a shovel because they didn't want to fire people? They didn't want to reduce the workforce and have a clause like a political firestorm. And then they did do the steam shovel. And guess what? Everybody went and got better jobs and provided more value to the economy. And so, I think that's where we are today. Somebody that's just doing payroll right now or something, or they're doing accounts payable and it can really be automated, they can go get a better job doing something else, and they'll add more to the GDP than being able to automate that task. So when you add more to the GDP, you increase the output, the country gets wealthier, and as a whole, everybody gets wealthier together. So I'm really bullish on it. I'm really bullish because nobody's just going to go and sit at their house. They're going to go and do something. You and I would go make a company. You know what I mean? So people go do that. They're not just going to sit around in general, I think, the majority of people, and then they'll provide value, and you'll see a GDP explosion, I think. And you'll see some of the best growth maybe that's ever been seen.
Yeah. Is there anything on this AI topic that we haven't covered yet that's top of mind that you think the audience should be aware of?
We've been whacking all the moles on this one. So I'm trying to think, but you got me in the corner now. I'm trying to make sure I don't leave anything out. You can't think of anything, man.
Well, on that note, moving to fertilizer, since you're close to the fertilizer industry as well. I think there's been a lot of headlines about, obviously, the Strait of Hormuz messing up the supply chain for sulfur and helium, which are key inputs to fertilizer. What are you seeing on that end?
Yeah, it's not great. So now we're taking a little worse of a step. But I think there's three things to keep in mind. I won't hit on helium, but so you've got nitrogen. The way you make nitrogen is you use a ton of natural gas to superheat the air and cause a catalyst, and you take the nitrogen out of the air. So it's naturally occurring, but you take nitrogen out of the air. The atmosphere is 70% nitrogen, and then you turn it into ammonia or a UAN, and that's what you use to put on corn and things like that. So 30% of the natural gas flows out of Qatar, and it goes to places like India and China and Europe. And so they can't get their natural gas. So all of their nitrogen plants shut down. So they're not making very much nitrogen over there. So that's a big problem because they made the majority of the world's supply. So the US actually is a net importer. We have a lot of plants, but we actually bring in more than we export. So now the US producers are sitting there making they're obviously buying natural gas at $3 and they're making it. And everybody else is getting slammed on it in the rest of the world. So the US people like CF Industries and UAN stock, they're all doing really, really well, great years, everything. But But it's because there's such a tightness and they can export it to the rest of the world. That raises the prices here in the US. That's bad for the farmer because they have higher input costs. So I think that like that's number one. Nitrogen prices are up like 100%. So that's tough. And corn's not up 100%. So that's tough for the farmer. The second thing is that sulfur. So sulfur you actually put on corn, like, and that price is going up, of course. So that's bad. But the second thing is, you like try catalyze sulfur into sulfuric acid, and then you use sulfuric acid to melt phosphate ore. So when you're mining phosphate, you melt the ore, and that makes a phosphoric acid. Well, phosphoric acid is the base of like phosphate fertilizers. And so now the sulfur prices are so high that they can't make phosphate profitably. So they're shutting down. Like Mosaic is a publicly listed company. They're shutting down production in their phosphate plants because they can't get enough sulfuric acid. And so phosphate prices are now going through the roof, and sulfur prices, which is another key ingredient. And so you've got sulfur, phosphate, and nitrogen that are all getting are spiking really high in prices. At the same time, you don't see corn really necessarily reflecting that rally yet. So it's creating really tough farm economics. And what's really interesting for us is that our customers, so what we do at Twin State Inc., was started by my grandfather, is we buy nitrogen, we buy phosphate, and we buy potash and sulfur and zinc from people that make it. And we turn it into, like when you fertilize your yard, you get a blended fertilizer, right? So you get something that has all five of those ingredients and more, and then you put it on your yard. Well, we're the people that blend it all together. So we have to pay the higher input costs also. It's not like we're like, oh my gosh, prices are higher, we're making more. Like, it's exactly the opposite. Prices are higher and our quantity being sold is dropping because people are having to cut back because the prices are so expensive. So I mean, it's tough there. It's hard on the farmer. What we really need to see is a rally in corn, and then the economics will make sense again. And I think that's going to happen. It's just that it just takes time to have the commodities market react. These things are cyclical, but sometimes it takes a year to see reactions as you draw down stockpiles, things like that. So we'll see what happens. But not the best year for ag, I'd say.
Have you experienced an environment like this before? Is your family?
The farm crisis in the 80s was bad, and we're not near that. But that's when a lot of people are going bankrupt. But I would say that usually all of our customers use John Deere financing, which is, you know, kind of thought of as being very easy to get, because John Deere will like lend to, you know, they'll lend and they'll finance. They actually make more money financing, I think, from John Deere than they do from their tractors. Nobody seems to know that, but this year, John Deere is saying like, oh, you guys are so stretched, we won't lend to you. So they're going to like non-traditional lenders at much, much higher interest rates. So that's like, I mean, we might be seeing 40% of our customers that we sell to doing that. So that's not good to see. That means that like people are distressed and the assets are so, you know, the liabilities are becoming more than the assets. So people won't, traditional lenders are no longer lending to them. And that's usually what you see before you see bankruptcies, because after that, then obviously they can't pay the interest rate and they go bankrupt. So like, I hope we don't get there. I hope we see corn go up and the incomes go up and then everybody gets out of a tough spot. But there are, you know, you could see makings of a crisis here that could be similar.
Yeah. Very interesting times. You got the incredible optimism and growth potential with AI and then some supply chain disruptions messing up the food supply. But I think if I learned anything from 2020, 2021 specifically, is those supply chain disruptions can be fixed in time. Maybe.
Yeah. And part of the problem is that land prices just had gotten so high, right? So people kept buying higher and higher land, and you need a higher profit just to cover the cost of the land. And then they rent it out for more. And so some of it is just that the asset prices had been so high, kind of like how you could see like, you know, home prices getting too high in an area and then they kind of stall out for a while and fall. And, you know, I think there's some of that going on too, which is that this was like farming had been so safe. The land had been such a good investment that it was so reliable that just more momentum, money just kept pouring into it and it overpriced the land. And that exacerbated, you know, a tough time because rents are high and, you know, interest that you're paying on overpriced land is high and all that stuff.
Yeah. Maybe the agents can help us figure out a solution to these problems, you know?
That's good. I hadn't thought about that one yet.
Awesome. Well, John, again, thank you for hopping on at short notice. This was a fascinating, highly dense conversation. And I have a lot of people on here who are very, very skeptical of the AI thing, but just using it myself over the last couple of years, but with the agents over the last 5 months, it's become pretty obvious to me that this, there's a there, it's real. If you know how to use it, it can make you a better operator, and it's just going to be, there's just going to be a lag period before the broader market wakes up to that, begins implementing this. And if that happens, the demand for these tokens is going exponential. We're at the cusp of what we're going to see in the next decade.
Yeah, well, you've got a great show. You provide enormous value to your viewers through your insights. So I'm just happy to be a part of it. And thanks for having me on.
All right. Well, we'll link to John's X account, what he's doing at AOG in the show notes. And hopefully we can do this again soon.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you. And yeah, check out AOTG ETF if you guys are interested.
Awesome. Peace and love, freaks. Okay. Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad-free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad-free. Helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time. And until next time.